Audio from external sources is used throughout this episode. Please note that the opinions, ideas, and theories proposed by these sources may not necessarily reflect the views of the Sovereign Tech X hosts. Thanks for listening. The following is a presentation of the Sovereign podcast feed.
When you go to your favorite fast food restaurant, you're going to be eating a fake hamburger. You're going to go to the grocery store and buy a pound of fake hamburger or a fake steak, and you won't know that it was grown in some big corporation's laboratory. This is the nightmare world that they're taking us into. They're changing God's creation. Why? Because they want to be God. They want to do exactly what Lucifer did before the flood. It's why God destroyed it. He said he regretted that he ever made mankind because they were destroying his creation. The Bible says God is coming back to destroy those who are destroying the earth. So God is an environmentalist. He takes this very seriously. He created this planet. He created the universe. And he's watching these Luciferians destroy his planet, destroy the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, change human DNA. Why? They want to change human DNA so that you can't be born again. That's where they're going with this, to change the DNA of humans, so it will be impossible for a human to be born again. They want to create a race of soulless creatures on this planet.
Ellen Sovereign, biochemical engineer and sexpert. Dr. Brian Sovereign, SecOp specialist and master of the triple black arts. Two hosts.
One mind-blowing show.
The latest evolution of science, technology, health, entertainment, and history, as only Sovereign Tech could provide. It's Sovereign Tech.
Yes. The man of tomorrow is here for you for a little Sovereign Tech X, which if you take a few of the letters out of that, honestly, it spells sex. And there's only one person that I want to have sex with. Wait a minute. What am I saying?
Hello, but... Clary.
Whoa. That got weird fast.
Well, if you consider the topic we're going to be talking about tonight, it kind of is relevant.
Hannibal the Cannibal. All right. I don't know if this will be Silence of the Lambs, but be the silence of something. Silence of the Blood of the Lamb? Wait, I don't know. Maybe that'll make sense when we get to it in a minute. But yeah, Ellen, welcome, of course, to Sovereign Tech X.
Thanks for having me.
This has been great. We've been getting this in every week.
I hope it continues.
Oh, it will. It will. And like we've talked about, we have a whole other podcast planned.
We do.
That we're working out. And if you want to help, if listeners want to help make that a reality, all you got to do is go to fundraiser.sovereigntech.com. That's our GoFundMe page. Already had some very gracious donations, and I'm so honored by that. But we got to get in some new equipment because we're going to be doing video. I mean, we're going to get this.
We are.
Yes, I am going to have my gorgeous wife on video. I mean,
wow, that's
worth
it alone. Start wearing less clothing.
Thank you. Exactly. See, folks, this is why I married this woman. No, it's not the only reason, but it's part of it. But yes, you'll have to wear, yeah, I don't know. We could get some outfits, you know, look a little revealing. What do you think? No.
I'm liking the, you know, it puts the lotion on its skin kind of vibe tonight.
Wow. All right. So anyway, folks, if you want to see all that, go to our OnlyFans. No, wait a minute. No. our GoFundMe. Sorry, those get confusing all the time. Go to our GoFundMe, again, at fundraiser.sovereigntech.com. You can read all the details there. But again, we're trying to raise $5,000 because we need new equipment to be able to do video right, and so much more. Like and if we do less than 5,000, I'll figure out how to make it work. If we do more than 5,000, believe me, all of it just goes right into doing more with the show, with the shows, frankly, than I even, you know, initially planned. And that'd be awesome to even get higher end equipment. We got some pretty amazing stuff planned.
Yeah, it would be awesome. And all of you guys are awesome because you continue to support Brian, even though he's fucking crazy.
I know. I don't know how the hell that works. I mean,
it's just like you're encouraging him to be more crazy. Do you really want this?
It was so funny. A great friend of mine, he was messaging me and he says, how do you get away with this? He's like, you're on your Instagram. You're calling everybody losers. You're saying that you're better than everyone and all stuff.
Yeah.
And people just eat it up. And
what's up with that?
They're just looking like, they're just like, yeah, give me more. Give me more. Anyway. But yeah, I mean, I'm amazed at the support I get, considering just how insane I am. Yeah. Yeah, seriously. I mean, I've even like, yeah, I don't know how this works. Anyway, regardless, folks, fundraiser.sovereigntech.com. Believe me, it helps and it will help me be even more crazy. And it'll actually, I think it's going to make Mrs. Sovereign go pretty crazy.
It's going to make me go a little wild and crazy. And that's
should,
true.
Yeah. You should see her when she gets wild and crazy. Woo! Holy shit. they don't make tables strong enough. Okay, so
follow up that statement.
I said that out loud. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. Okay. Anyway, yeah, how do you follow that up? Well, this might end up being a shorter show than what some people have been used to. We've been doing some 3-hour opuses lately. But this one, we've got one story only that we're going to get into. Now, I want to make something really clear. Okay, we're going to have one story, and then we're going to get in a review. And you're going to make a statement that I think is going to shock the world. In fact, why don't we lead off with that statement?
Right now?
Right now. What that, and that statement being, we're going to get in review later. We got a story to get into, and I want to put just a touch preamble on this story.
We're going to change the world with this statement.
Yeah. What would you say, Ellen, is the greatest interpretation, you know, on film of Frank Herbert's Dune?
Well, at this point in my life, as far as I am aware, anyway, I would say...
Well, there's only three, right?
That it is the television series.
The miniseries from the Sci-Fi Channel in 2000. You're saying that is the best rendition of Dune.
It's the fucking best.
Wow. I mean, I might have
just...
By
far and away.
You know, people say I'm crazy. I might have just lost all my listeners just now.
Okay, well, I think that there's probably a lot of people out there that have never seen it, and
oh, I agree
if that's
with that.
The case, I highly, highly, highly recommend this if you're interested at all in Dune, and when I say Dune, I mean the book series, and
right.
Not, you know, just the modern rendition of the, you know, the movie that is currently in theaters.
Right, right. Yeah, a movie kind of... being a little generous, but anyway, with the term. But
yeah,
anyway.
I mean, it is sort of like a 3-part movie series.
Yeah, well, that, and it's also a sonic lobotomy, but regardless, so there's your statement, and we're gonna pay that tease later, even though you kind of paid it, but we're gonna explain.
Yeah, you already gave it all away.
Yeah, well, I wanted to, because people, I want them to get to the end, I want them to know, you know, why they need to be here to the end.
Why is it the best?
For you to justify that statement, you know, and because I think that needs justification, and I'm excited to hear about it.
I don't have to justify anything.
Damn straight.
But I will anyway.
That's
right. Because that's why we're here.
That's right.
We love to hear ourselves talk.
Yes, we do. And so do you, all of you. Though sometimes people do complain when we talk about our diet.
They complain.
Yeah, I've seen some complaints.
Is it because we get a little preachy? Do we come off as like harsh to meat eaters?
Maybe. You do. No, just kidding.
I have no sympathy, just like you have no sympathy for the animals that you consume on a daily basis.
Wow. Okay. Well, anyway, I want to be clear on this. So we are going to talk about veganism/vegetarianism. We are not talking about it from like a defend this diet position, because we're going to talk about somebody who came out with the most whacked out theory of, you know, why you shouldn't be a vegetarian/vegan. And I want to get into that. And there's a lot to explore and expand upon with this. But I want to be clear, like, that the only person preaching is the person we're reading about. So, but not that I mind. I don't mind, like, making people a little uncomfortable. I enjoy that.
It's good to question your basic beliefs every now and again.
Absolutely. So, all right, we're going to talk about a guy, none other than Rick Wiles. Some of you will need an explanation for that. The rest of you are laughing your asses off, most likely. Better listening to the sound of my voice. So Rick Wiles is a guy who, he's a broadcaster would be a generous term, speaking of generous terms. But Rick Wiles he's basically a even more hyper-Christian Alex Jones. And that really kind of says everything. Like he has his own InfoWars. He just calls it True News. And he's had this stuff for a while, and he's been involved in like the event, you know, televangelist space, for decades, like since I was a little kid. He was running things at like the Trinity Broadcasting Network, TBN, which I remember that very well, from when I was younger. And, you know, he's been a part of all these different things, and he had a radio show for a long time. But then, you know, he was getting kicked off, apparently, whatever. People can check this history. That's fine. But he ended up at some point, much like Alex Jones, just going like the full transmit on the internet route. Okay. And this guy, really, if you look into him more, it seems like there's not a conspiracy theory that he doesn't like. And in this sense, I don't always like to use conspiracy theory in the derogatory, but in this sense, I kind of do. Makes rampant anti-Semitic statements while at the same time saying he doesn't want any harm to come to Jews. And it's like, well, wait, which is it? But, again, just picture like somehow perhaps an even more extreme Alex Jones. And that's basically how you end up with this guy. So with that said, and obviously, like I said, hyper-Christian, you know, big time, like fundamentalist type Christian, within the realm of those televangelists, which, boy, a lot of those guys, actually, I wouldn't even call them fundamentalists, but I don't want to get lost on a side subject. But, you know, a lot of the people who used to be on TBN, these guys have insane ideas, like Ken Johnson and like Benny Hinn and not
Benny
Hill.
That sounds like an episode all on its own.
Oh, it totally could be. The stories I could regale. But regardless, I want to get into what he said about what Rick Wiles said about, you know, eating these Beyond Burgers or Impossible Burgers.
Well, no, that's not what he's talking about.
Go for it.
He said meatless burgers.
Yeah, meatless burgers. Right.
So this is something I wanted to talk about after you started reading it.
Aha.
But this is a point of contention that I have with what you're saying.
Okay. Because you're basically saying are you inferring that he's going after, like, the entire vegetarian-vegan diet?
Pretty much. I mean, where do you draw the line? How deep does the conspiracy go
when
it comes to meatless? Is it Beyond Burgers and, you know, things that are created in laboratories or genetically modified? Or is it simply the bean burger or the soy burger or even the portobello mushroom burger?
Right. Well, I think you're on point. As we read the story, I think you'll see that he is basically condemning anyone that doesn't eat meat, which is a very strange thing to say. What do you got?
Yeah, agreed.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to say.
Okay, so this is coming from The Friendly Atheist, who actually has a really great newsletter that the friend I mentioned earlier, that I quoted earlier, he actually turned me on to this. But anyway, from the friendly atheist, Rick Wiles, eating meatless burgers will lead to, quote, a race of soulless creatures, end quote. Now,
when I saw this story, I sent it to you and I was like, fire up the grill.
And I shared it right on Instagram. Yeah. I was like, yeah, fire up the grill. Yeah. So we saw like an account that you and I both follow on Instagram shared like the meme, the screenshot of this. And this was just a few days ago. But the story itself is actually from 2019, just for clarity. But I think there's still so much to talk about and unpack from this. That even though the story is from 2019, it's worthwhile to discuss. And I especially wanted your opinion on this, Ellen, because, well, anyway, I think it's going to be interesting. So, shall we read?
Yes.
Here we go. End Times broadcaster and anti-Semite Rick Wiles, last seen explaining how pro-choice people would be eternally aborted by demons in hell.
I wonder how that works.
All right. I could get into a side subject on that, but we'll keep going. Said on a recent episode of True News, and like I just said, True News is basically his version of InfoWars, that meatless burgers are part of a satanic plot to turn people away from God. His logic, and I use that word very generously, boy, we're using a lot of generous words in this episode, is that a plant-based alternative to meat is subverting God's master plan to have us eat his other creations. So, all right, I'll keep reading.
What does he mean by that?
Therefore, if you're eating these vegetarian patties, you're actually rejecting God. Now, I mean, all right, Stallion breaking in. I mean, we could stop right on that. Like, you know, the idea that if you are eating these plant-based alternatives to meat, it is subverting God's master plan to have us eat his other creations.
God has a master plan, and it's for us to consume the flesh of the creatures that we share this planet with?
It's a mighty weird thing to say.
And also that if we eat meatless burgers, that we're telling God to fuck off, basically.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have a problem with that part.
Yeah. Well, let's read his quote. I hear you. It's like, oh, wait, so I'm going to hell? Well, great. That's where all the fun people are. All right. Can I have another?
Yeah, I don't have to obey God's commands.
Right, I'll take that impossible burger, thank you.
Or I'll just eat, like, a soy burger, that's fine too.
Right, yeah, or a classic white bean burger or something.
Or a black
like that.
Bean burger.
Black bean burger, yeah.
Or black and white bean burger.
Holy shit, you're not just going to hell, you're going to, I don't know.
How about a veggie burger made with quinoa and peas and broccoli?
Well, you know what's crazy? All right. I mean, I'll say this quick before we read his quote, because, you know, let's not put words in the guy's mouth, you know, I mean, let alone put an impossible burger in his mouth. But let's not put words in his mouth. OK,
no, let's shove one down his mouth.
Yeah, let's shove. But like one of the Christian denominations that I have the slightest shred remaining of respect for are the Seventh-day Adventists, and the hardcore Seventh-day Adventists, by command of their prophetess. And they would argue, and I would say rightfully so, by biblical precept, are vegans. They teach it right alongside the Bible. You know, now they don't say you're going to go to hell if you're not a vegan. And there are certainly plenty of Adventists that will eat beef, turkey, and anything that doesn't break Leviticus 16, basically kashrut law, or Leviticus 30, sorry. Most of them are vegan, and, you know, and they come up all the time because there was that research done in the United States of the longest living population within the United States, and the Seventh-day Adventists blew it away. Like they were, and then
they created the green zone in California, basically.
Right. Or now it's like the blue zone, whatever. Anyway, they get talked a lot about in health studies. And they also run like one of the major medical research institutes in the United States, Loma Linda University. So, you know, I mean, effectively here, like Rick Wiles, massive Christian, he just condemned every Seventh-day Adventist.
Well, let's play devil's advocate for a minute.
Oh, okay. I love that game.
Okay. which is weird because we're talking about somebody who's arguing for following the commandments of,
sure.
of God,
sure.
our Father,
sure.
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Wow. So, sorry. The water I was just grabbing started boiling while you were saying that. That got strange. Okay, continue. Oh, no, it's just seltzer. That's why it boiled. Whoops. Anyway, please.
So, what are there any commandments in the Bible that say that we have to eat meat?
No.
So that's a fallacy.
Yeah.
That he's basing this whole thing on.
Yeah, 100%. Yes. I mean, this is the part that I can speak to. I certainly want you to speak more to his claims, his like quote unquote scientific claims. Okay. But to your point, yeah, no. In fact, meat eating does not seem to be a part of the program, basically, until you get into the Noahide laws, which get implemented after the flood. It's argued that they existed since the beginning, but there is a law given by God after the flood that says you can't eat the limb of an animal that's still alive. But that's the first law in the books. That chronologically, anyway, if you believe the chronology of Torah or of the first five books of the Bible, that's the first time that meat eating gets talked about. Otherwise, everything we know about people's diets before then, like in the garden or even after the garden, other than Abel killing a lamb, but he just kills it and makes it a sacrifice to God. It doesn't say anything about him eating it. The only thing we know about their diet is they're basically fruitarians. And then it would appear maybe they became, what would be more vegan or vegetarian after getting kicked out of the Garden of Eden, because it does say that they had to plow the land. But that's the only insinuation you get out of that. Otherwise, in Eden, it seems like all they did was eat fruit. There was no meat in the original plan. In fact, the first death is recorded. Basically, whatever is the first killing on earth is recorded in Genesis, which was the lamb that God himself killed to put clothing over Adam and Eve after they ate the apple, after the fall. So eating animals would appear to not be a part of God's plan for creation, actually. Even after because where most people pull up this idea that there is a law for this, it comes out of what is known as dominion theology. And that whole statement comes out of Genesis, where after God creates Adam, he says that he has dominion over all the beasts of the field. Okay. And so because of that, there are Christians who believe in dominion theology that think now suddenly they have control of the whole earth and we're in charge of things. That's not what that verse means at all, but that's besides the point. The point being is that even when Adam is told he has dominion over the beasts of the earth, he doesn't eat them. He was only eating fruit. Again, the first death we know chronologically was just the one that gave them clothing, if we're to believe that the Bible is even real history. Okay, so there's all of that. Do you want me to get to his quote, or do you have comments on any of that?
I think it's interesting. So you're saying there's no laws about humans eating meat, but I do recall you saying that there was... I don't know if it was a commandment, but maybe like burning meat was a sweet savor unto the Lord.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's that. So let me make a slight correction that there are, when you get to Levitical law, when you get to the written Torah, and if you believe in the oral Torah, it's certainly in there as well. Then suddenly there are laws about what you can and can't eat. Like you can't eat an animal that chews from the cud, but doesn't have a cloven hoof. Okay. So like you can't eat, that's where like why you can't eat pork. Okay. So there's that. There are laws around what you can't eat, but there's not a positive law that says you must eat meat. Okay. But there are lots of little laws like, you can't, you know, cook, the kid of a mother goat in its milk or whatever. I mean, like there's lots of these little laws around how you can handle meat, for sure. But there is no positive law that says you must eat meat. That was my point.
After Adam and Eve ate the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Yep.
Civilization was the curse that God put on this planet. And
Yes.
Because people became civilized, they started just eating all of the, like, not just the plants from the ground, which they now had to plow, but mm-hmm. also just whatever animals were around that they could find. So they were eating, like, just fucking everything, and God was like, all right, maybe you shouldn't eat it while it's still alive, and maybe you shouldn't do really weird things like
yeah,
cook a baby goat in its mother's own milk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah. You can't eat, like, these dirty animals.
Right. Yeah, so basically what happens is you get, like, before, and I mentioned earlier the Noahide laws, okay, which are these seven laws that apply to all of humanity. This is according to Judaism, okay? And these laws are extrapolated from the verse about not eating from the tree of knowledge of fruit and blah, blah, blah. Not eating from the tree of knowledge. We'll just call it that. And also, you know, coming out of be fruitful and multiply. Like it's coming. They extrapolate these different laws out of that initial command. And then the seventh one doesn't come until after the flood. That's why they're called the Noahide laws, because the seventh one, which says you can't eat the limb off of an animal that's still alive. You know, that ends up becoming the seventh one. Now, later on, you get to, you know, the time of Moses, and that's when you get the, you know, the Ten Commandments and the you know, the laws that were brought down from Mount Sinai. And that's suddenly when all of these other laws appear. Okay. There's an argument that the one about the Sabbath didn't or pre-existed the Ten Commandments. That's a whole other animal, no pun intended. But all of those laws, and there's just a very quick point I want to bring up, because all of the laws, and I say this as a Kabbalist, okay, all of the laws that were given to Moses and that Moses gave to the people about what to do with eating meat and all that, okay, like kashrut law, all of that was because the Israelites sinned because they worshiped the golden calf. If they didn't do that, if the golden calf incident didn't happen, according to Judaism, none of the mitzvot, the laws, none of those laws, none of the Torah would have been necessary. So you're completely right in your point that we were cursed with civilization. And civilization is what actually brought on, you know, arguably what brought on the golden calf incident and that great sin. And basically it was God realizing, okay, well, you people aren't going to live the way I actually created you, my actual plan. And so I'm going to have to give you an ass ton of laws. I'm going to have to give you 613 laws. And that's going to include what you can and can't eat, how to cook it and everything else. Make sure you don't fuck a camel and, you know, and all this jazz. Okay. And that's where all of those come from.
Yeah, that worked out really well.
Yeah, right. Because, I mean, you know, I have family in Israel. I mean, I'm pretty sure some of them fucked a camel or two. Wait, no. Sorry. that was weird.
What?
Okay, forget that. I'm just saying, like, if you had to make the law, it's because people were doing it.
Exactly.
And that's a problem.
That's okay. True.
Right. Yeah. So I get it. Like, I get
somebody
it.
Somebody tried it.
Yeah, I understand why Hashem felt like, oh, yeah, I got to do this. I got to give you guys laws. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you guys can't do that.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
Right, right. So, which, I mean, to be clear, folks, also, like, yes, I said I'm a Kabbalist, but as I've constantly reminded, I don't believe in a God, not a sky daddy God whatsoever. I am an atheist, just like the guy that wrote this article. So, anyway, I love the point that you made, and I just really wanted to give some foundation to that. Based upon, again, we're playing by this, by Rick Wiles' rules. Okay. He's using the Bible to justify his position. So I'll use it right back at him and explain, actually, you know, you're dead wrong, fucker. Like, if God had a master plan, if there is a God, if God had a master plan, civilization wasn't a part of it. And not only that, meat eating was clearly not a part of it. Like, it's not there until significant, until arguably thousands of years, or at least 1,000 years, after the entire fall incident, you know, of eating the fruit. So what do you got?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're the historian here.
Sure.
What about the part that I brought up earlier about burning meat as like an incense to God?
Yeah, so this is a thing for the priesthood, specifically for the priesthood to do. Now, like I said, If you're buying the history as it's written in the book of Genesis, okay, you do have the situation of Cain and Abel, right? Cain brings to God as a sacrifice. He brings a bunch of fruits, vegetables, whatever. He brings a harvest. Okay. You think that's a fine thing. Apparently God's not happy about that. Abel rather brings a sacrificed lamb. Okay. And burns it and sends up that sweet savor that the Bible keeps, or that, you know, Torah keeps repeating. So God has a thing for blood, it seems, or he has a thing for that smell. Obviously God doesn't eat the lamb. There's no record of anything like that. And certainly within Judaism itself, they're like, no, God doesn't have a mouth. Like he couldn't do it anyway. Okay. But he does seem to have a nose of some kind and enjoys smelling these things. I mean, that's a completely separate argument to get into.
He just loves glutamate.
Right. Right. Now the priesthood later on. Yeah. He loves glutamate. Now, the priesthood later on, when you get into, say, the book of Exodus, you get into the later books of Moses, they are commanded to, like, the sacrifice of the lamb in their rituals is part of their portion, and they are to eat some of it, okay? And it's always a very pure animal. Like, once again, you have these laws where it's got to be, like, it can't have any blemishes, it's got to be absolutely perfect, all of which lends to an odd understanding, frankly, of advanced medical knowledge, which I've brought up a million times on the show. But anyway, there is that. Okay. But the part that I think a lot of people miss, including many of my fellow Jews, is there, like, that's only one type of sacrifice. There actually are whole other systems of sacrifice that are exactly what Cain did, you know, where he just brought fruits and nuts and whatever else, you know, and all of that. And those are the more prevalent and common, you know. So even to argue for the killing of animals and eating that meat, that's a very particular thing. And there is no part of that whatsoever, in my opinion, that I can see where it says, oh no, this is part of God's plan. Like this is how it was meant to be. And when you get later on into the Bible, you know, you get to Isaiah 65, one of the most contentious chapters in the entire Bible, you know, it's seems to be pretty clear. The lion's going to lay with the lamb. There's not going to be, I mean, there's going to be some kind of death, but nobody's going to be killing anything. Wars will end and, you know, swords get turned into plowshares. And when it's saying the lion will lay with the lamb, I mean, if you're to take that literally, like it seems like Rick Wiles likes to take everything literally, that would infer that animals won't even eat each other, you know? And this is something that the Adventists actually argue for, is that after the fall, they argue that all species on planet Earth were vegetarian or vegan. Like everything, every lions, all of them.
Oh, you mean before the fall?
Before the fall. Yeah. And that after the fall, that changed everything, you know, biologically, like there was just this massive shift, and instantaneous one at that. Now, of course that sounds ridiculous and it is, but That's their argument. And these are people, you know, I would always argue, and actually the Catholic Church argues this as well. If you wanted to just live by the Bible and the Bible alone, Old Testament, New Testament, if that's all you want to do, you don't want any extraneous traditions whatsoever. What do? You become a Seventh-day Adventist. The Catholic Church will tell you that. I'd tell you the same thing. You know, if you just want to follow Old Testament, New Testament to the letter, you become a Seventh-day Adventist. But that's what these people believe, is that, you know, like, again, they're following the Bible word for word, far better than Rick Wiles. And they're telling you, no, motherfucker, you should be a vegan. Not only should you be a vegan, but every animal on planet Earth is actually meant to be vegan. So he's way off base on that, even if I were to buy into his notions of, you know, whatever concepts he gets from Jesus. Anyway, I feel like I've been talking forever. Do you have any questions on anything I just said?
Do you actually believe that part about all animals being vegans before the fall?
No. I mean, I think so just quickly, like, I do think that there is some historical truth in the book of Genesis. Okay. And there's actually a lot of scientific truth within the book of Genesis. Again, I'm not Christian. I'm sure there's plenty of Jews who would say, you know, even if my ethnicity is what it is, I'm not Jewish for some of the things I believe. But regardless, a lot of Kabbalists actually firmly believe, they believe in, you know, like a pre-Adamism, effectively that there were people before Adam and that Adam was another attempt by quote unquote God at humanity, like that he kept messing up.
Yeah, well, he messed up with us, too. Well, I mean, clearly he said, like, well, we're not supposed to eat meat, but OK, I guess you can just like don't do that disgusting stuff.
Yeah, right. Well, that would be the argument, is that Adam messed up as well, which we're, quote unquote, the descendants of. I mean, that gets into a very complicated history. But ultimately, what I'm saying is that, no, the theory of evolution is absolutely real. And the idea that, you know, everything just popped up 6,000 years ago or so and everything changed overnight is not at all what Torah is saying. Like, not even close. And not only that, but again, there were plenty of creatures, including other humans, that pre-existed the one called Adam. So there we go. So there's, I don't think I exactly answered what I believe, but I gave some fun things to think about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you would never truly say what you believe just flat out like that. I get it.
No, any good cult leader can't do that. Yeah,
gotta stay mysterious.
You do. You do. You have to keep them guessing. Otherwise, you lose your leadership position, right? Because then they don't need you anymore once you give them everything.
This sounds familiar.
Hold on. Wait, is this what Rick Wiles does? No. What does it sound like?
I heard this from an asset leader once.
Oh, yeah. Oh, corporate cult. Yeah, totally. I'm sure they use the old playbook.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I really don't do that, folks. Like, if you ask, here's the thing. I will answer pretty much any question that gets asked of me, you know, and I'll answer it as directly as I can. The thing is, you got to know what questions to ask.
Right.
And
you just have to keep asking more and more questions.
Right. And that's the hard part, is knowing what questions to ask. But, you know, to quote Dune, like the Mentats say, don't collect answers, collect questions. So anyway, that's how you deal with anybody like me or corporate asshats.
Take that, Rick Wiles.
Yeah, yeah. Or Rick Wiles. Not that I'm in any way anything like those people. So,
your eyes look awfully shifty right now.
Wait, am I blinking horizontally?
I think I saw those nictitating membranes.
Oh, shit. Try to hide that. All right. So why don't we get it straight from the horse's mouth here? I don't know if he ate the horse, but regardless, let's get it straight from the horse's mouth on what Rick Wiles actually said, getting back to our story. So here we go. Quote, God is an environmentalist.
Is okay. he?
I mean, that's a nice statement.
Created the environment, so I'd say he's pretty pro-environment.
Yeah, yeah. but he keeps going on. Quote, he takes this very seriously. He created this planet. He created the universe, and he's watching these Luciferians destroy this planet, destroy the animal kingdom, destroy the plant kingdom, change human DNA. Why? They want to change human DNA so that you can't be born again. And I'm guessing, end quote there, I'm guessing he means they, as in the Luciferians or the Satanists.
The Luciferians. I've been called more creative things.
Yeah, yeah. if people were a member of my Patreon, I've actually, in the past like month, done some pretty deep dives on the concept of Lucifer and what that actually means. And, I mean, I can give you a small preview, just that the name Lucifer isn't a name. Like, it doesn't mean shit, you know?
it's much more amazing than a name.
Yeah, right. It just means morning star. It's just Venus. Like, that's all it is. It doesn't...
No, it's more than that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I go into a lot more.
The bringer of light.
Yes, but that, it's not what the Bible meant when it used, because this was, all right, very quickly. This is my point, is that the word Lucifer shows up nowhere in the Bible.
Right.
It shows up in a translation of the Bible called the Vulgate, which was done long after the Old Testament was written. Okay. It's in Latin. Which nobody, you know, Jesus didn't speak Latin. The ancient Hebrews didn't speak Latin, right? The Romans spoke Latin.
The Romans did. Conjugate.
Yeah.
Conjugate.
Right. And so this idea of Lucifer, like there's nobody named Lucifer. The word didn't fucking exist, you know, until like at best, maybe 2000 some odd years ago. That's it. You know, like it wasn't a part of the program. But most Christians just, they don't know and they don't care. Because they're idiots. But anyway, so But if you want to be a patron, of course, patreon.com/sovereign. And yes, it's /sovereign.
And if you're a Christian, you probably don't want to be a patron anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless that. You want some hard truth. But, you know.
Yeah.
Like the guy said, talk hard. Anyway. Okay. So we'll keep going. Here we go. Quote, that's why they're going with this. To change the DNA of humans so it will be impossible for a human to be born again. They want to create a race of soulless creatures on this planet.
So what I want to know is how did he find out about this plot? How did he discover that us Luciferians want to make soulless creatures out of humans?
I know. I mean, I got the memo, but I was told not to share with anybody.
Right. It's so confidential.
Right. So, yeah, I honestly, the big problem I have with this story is, wait a minute, what fucking lizard opened their mouth? You know? They slipped the tongue, you know? This is not okay. But anyway, great point, Ellen.
Thank you.
Yeah, how did he find this out? He would probably say it came from, like, divine inspiration.
Divine inspiration, yeah. The answer for everything.
Yeah, isn't it, though? Yeah, total horseshit. So, I mean, but I want to ask you, Ellen, like, I mean, what is there any truth? I mean, he's obviously, you know, a moron. Okay. But is there any truth to the statement that, like, what you eat could change your DNA or no?
Well, actually,
maybe I was a little too soon on old slap nuts here. Maybe Rick Wiles isn't so stupid. Tell me more.
Well, so I don't know that there's any evidence that any kind of food can remove a soul from a person.
Well, that's a loaded situation.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah. I mean, you first have to, like, discover what is a soul, where does it reside, how do you remove it?
Right.
And, you know, lobotomies aren't always the answer. But there is a small grain of truth in what he's saying, that certain types of food, in fact, all food, can alter your genetic code. And not that it necessarily directly alters the code, like CATG. It doesn't, like, swap out those. I mean, sometimes you can get a virus and maybe that'll do it. Or you'll have, like, an error in translation. But generally, when those things happen, either your cells will repair themselves or they will commit suicide.
What happens when they do that?
They don't reproduce. They commit apoptosis and they die.
Right.
And that's how your cells are able to continue to be healthy, because occasionally one will sacrifice itself if it's not healthy. So what I'm saying is, food doesn't directly alter your genetic code in that sense, but it does affect your genetic expression. And for people who don't understand what that means, I'll kind of unpack what I mean when I say genetic expression. So everybody knows that we have this genome that's, like, wrapped up into chromosomes, and we have a bunch of different chromosomes in our body.
Mm-hmm.
But they're packaged in these tight coils, and whenever a certain part of your genome needs to reproduce itself, like, say, you need to make a certain protein, or like your body's getting these hormonal signals saying, make more of this specific protein.
Mm-hmm.
You have molecules that will unpackage that coil and expose it so that it's able to be replicated. And there are molecules that hook on to the genome at certain points that say, like, attach here and detach here. And if you're eating certain foods that, or, I mean, any food that you eat really can alter that expression, in the sense that, like, it will unpack certain parts of your DNA or coil up and package tightly other parts of your DNA. So everybody more or less has the same genome.
Right.
But we have different expressions. So I don't know if that helps explain that a little more.
Okay, so
do you have a better visual, maybe?
Sure, right. Okay, so what you eat would not, could not change your genome unless it was like injected with some kind of like virus and it was transmitted that way. Or could not change your DNA.
Pretty much. I mean, altering a person's DNA. I mean, I work in an industry where we alter the DNA of living cells. And that's a pretty energy intensive process.
Right.
And a lot of cells die in the process. So I think that that's more of a challenging thing than just eating food. Because your body actively protects itself against that kind of alteration. Like, when you go outside and spend a lot of time in the sun and you get a sunburn, what actually happens is the high energy radiation is, like, bombarding your body. And that is essentially, like, changing your DNA by breaking it or hitting it with super high intensity energy.
Right.
And your body responds with a lot of inflammation because it's killing off those cells or trying to repair it or repair the damaged DNA. Your body doesn't really tolerate any alterations to your genome that well.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel very much like this is his gay frog statement, you know?
Yeah. Like it's almost kind of true, but not really.
Right. Right.
I actually wondered if you wouldn't mind me sharing a little bit from an article just to talk about this a little more.
Yeah, please. Deep dive.
Okay.
Let's do it. He has another point where I think he's right, but I'll save that. Go for it.
Okay. So I'm just going to read this small section of an article on the website, The Conversation, called What You Eat Can Reprogram Your Genes. An expert explains the emerging science of nutrigenomics.
All right. Okay. Let's do this.
Yeah. It's like nutrient genomics. Nutrigenomics. Along with calories and nutrients, food can influence the genetic blueprints that shape who you are. This is written by Monica Duss from the University of Michigan.
Okay.
So I'm not going to start from the beginning. I'm going to go about halfway down.
Sure.
So she's saying, how is food translated into biological instructions? Remember that food is composed of macronutrients. These include carbohydrates, sugars, proteins, and fats. Food also contains micronutrients, such as vitamins and minerals. These compounds and their breakdown products can trigger genetic switches that reside in the genome. Like the switches that control the intensity of the light in your house, genetic switches determine how much of a certain gene product is produced. Royal jelly, for instance, contains compounds that activate genetic controllers to form the queen's organs and sustain her reproductive ability. So that's a really great example. Like all bees kind of are born the same.
Right.
But what makes a queen bee is that she gets fed royal jelly, whereas no other bees get fed that.
Okay.
So continuing on. In humans and mice, byproducts of the amino acid methionine, which are abundant in meat and fish, are known to influence genetic dials that alter cell growth and division. And vitamin C plays a role in keeping us healthy by protecting the genome from oxidative damage.
Which, there's an irony, quick, if I can inject, about methionine, because that's something we were actually complaining about in the last episode, saying, like, well, methionine's a problem, but protein, you know, part of protein, that's an issue, which is why you don't want to eat meat, right?
Yeah, because it kind of speeds up that cell growth and division.
Yeah, yeah. So if Rick Wiles is playing by his own rules, you'd be like, oh, actually, methionine, ugh. You know, but
it'll kill you faster.
Yeah, right. Anyway, please continue.
Sure. So vitamin C keeps us protected from oxidative damage. It also promotes the function of cellular pathways that can repair the genome if it does get damaged. Kind of like what I was talking about with sunburn. So depending on the type of nutritional information, the genetic controls activated and the cells that receive them, the messages in food can influence wellness, disease risk, and even lifespan. But it's important to note that to date, most of these studies have been conducted in animal models, like bees. Interestingly, the ability of nutrients to alter the flow of genetic information can span across generations. Studies show that in humans, and animals, the diet of grandparents influences the activity of genetic switches and the disease risk and mortality of grandchildren.
So, you know, hearing this, though, I mean, you're kind of making his case. Granted, that's playing more, say, on a generational level, or it's in the case of the bees, right, that eating at a young age the right thing will turn you into something else than that's different from all the other bees. But you're still really a bee. Doesn't it seem like that? Or am I not hearing you correctly?
The thing is, what he's saying about making people that don't have souls, I mean, let's just agree that's not going to happen. You know, people are either born with or without souls.
Ooh.
Or maybe they sell their souls doing certain actions. You know, maybe you can lose your soul over time.
Well,
based on whatever conscience you may or may not have. But I don't think necessarily this is the conversation to get into, like, do we even believe in a soul? And
yeah,
what is the soul?
Yeah. I would be worried, you know, if he's like saying that, like, you're not going to have a soul, like, well, then I don't have a bargaining chip. Like, I sold mine for a pretty good chunk of change, and like, that'd be terrible. You know, that's the inheritance of every Jew, right? That's our Jew gold around our neck, is we get to sell our soul to Satan, and, you know, we get that for our bar mitzvah. But no, I'm kidding. Okay. Just one second on the soul part. If I can just inject quickly, okay. This is the part where I think he might kind of be, he's right for the wrong reasons.
Okay. Can we come back to that?
Yeah, no, fine. Okay. We'll come back to
because
that.
Because
I'm
not done talking.
Please.
About, you know, making Rick Wiles? Is
yeah,
that his name?
Rick Wiles.
Yeah, his case.
Yeah.
So, I mean, eating food, what you eat, what your parents and grandparents ate, yes, that does change your genetic expression. That's true. I don't know that it would necessarily... I don't know. This is a challenging one. Like, it's not going to take away your soul.
I
think that what people eat on a long enough time span does alter their epigenetics,
right,
which is what we would call this. I mean, in the article I was reading, they call it nutrigenomics.
Right.
But I think that is kind of a subset of epigenetics.
Yeah.
Because epigenetics is basically the study of... genetic expression. It's like the study of the genome, but like not necessarily changes in the genome itself, just the expression of it and what alters that.
Right.
So I think this is complicated, and I kind of want to go down the road that you were just bringing up too, because that kind of plays into it. So I'm going to say yes and no. He's right that what you eat does change you, and
yes,
it changes your progeny as well.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm thinking about how often people eat burgers, and it's probably not enough to, like, make a huge difference.
Yeah.
And not enough to lose your soul over.
Okay, yeah. I mean, even forget, like, we'll talk more about the soul, but forget even the part about the soul. Like, the important thing to bring up. So, he can say this, and... just like Alex Jones would do from time to time, he might have some research to back him up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some independent research to back up his assertion.
Because
right?
The gay frog thing actually turned out to be like transgender frogs that were being...
Yes.
They weren't gay necessarily, but like they were switching genders.
Right, right. Which we've all seen Jurassic Park. We know how that goes.
Right.
So life finds a way. Okay, so... but...
and this is like... you're going to lose your soul over eating meatless patties? Well, no, but like your genes do, the expression alters a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the important things to get out about this is, okay, but this isn't a plan, right? Like that's kind of the idea is because, okay.
Well,
fingers raised. Okay, go.
So it's, it's not a plan by the Luciferians, right? Because
yes.
I think there's definitely some big business out there. And we've talked about this even recently on the last episode. Like companies that sell both meat and meatless options.
Sure.
They're just playing both sides.
Right.
Because they want to make money.
Right.
But they're not necessarily interested in making healthy things. They just want to like hook in any market that they can. I think there is a plan in their mind to make a lot of money. And like, if you want to go full bore conspiratorial, yeah, maybe there is like a rich one percenter kind of conspiracy plan to reduce the population on this planet by allowing the vast majority of people to eat the most unhealthy processed crap that they possibly can to, you know, shorten their lives.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Now, I think there is actually very good evidence that there have been one percenters or, you know, exceptionally wealthy people that have engaged in programs, funds, whatever, business activity, whatever, that was designed to affect certain parts of the population. I mean, you can think of like the bridges to Coney Island, where they were meant, they were built low so that buses couldn't go underneath them. And that would keep black people who didn't, at the time, you know, 100 years ago, didn't have their own automobiles. They couldn't get there. Okay. So, like, the idea that there are racial actions, which you could even call eugenic actions, by wealthy, particularly even wealthy Americans, 100%. Yes. You know, even like the state parks program and all this stuff. Like, they want less people on planet Earth. Okay, like, I mean, I don't think that's too nutty to say.
Yeah, I don't think it's crazy considering that what you can get with food stamps is like cheese product,
right,
and what General Mills cereal.
Sure, sure. Or I mean, or look at the Georgia Guidestones, the previous Georgia Guidestones. They're not really there anymore. You know, somebody had the means to build that thing, whether it's a joke or what. But somebody had the means to build that thing, and on that thing, it specifically said, don't let the world's population get above 500 million people. Okay, so somebody of means wanted less people on planet Earth and took action to try and inspire that, you know? So basically, the idea that there are wealthy people out there that want less people and
Hell yeah.
will take action on that, yeah, of course. Okay, we don't even have to talk about George Bernard Shaw, but whatever. Like, they're out there. Okay. And they're here. They're not like from 100 years ago, even. I'm sure they're here right now. The only thing I'll say is that take your pick of the company that's playing both sides, like you talked about, Ellen, you know, like Morningstar Farms, whatever. Okay. There's a great phrase that I want people to really like walk away with this, or, you know, walk away from this with. And that is, we are not as organized to be as evil as you think we are. Now, just apply that phrase to any evil company, you know, that you think is out there. Okay. And that's the thing, like the level of organization you need to have to engage in an operation at a mass scale like this. I don't think, and I say this literally word for word, it's not humanly possible. As in humans can't do it, you know, like,
don't underestimate us.
Well, I mean, with certain technologies being democratized, you know, yes, the individual does become more and more capable. And that's every individual, not just the one percenters, right?
Yeah. But also take into consideration the effect that CEOs or company presidents have on the corporate culture
mm-hmm.
of an entire organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, again, at the same time, like, okay, could I see that a corporate CEO would have some kind of like depopulation dream in his mind? Yes. It's still a whole other thing to say that like that everybody that's like pushing, you know, whatever it is, the Sierra Club or I don't know, whoever, Club of Rome, take your pick of the group, you know, or the Bilderbergers or something, you know, fuck, it's in the name. But to say that these groups somehow can coordinate, right, that, oh, yeah, we're going to give everybody meatless burgers and we're going to turn them into like this race that can't be saved, into this soulless race. I mean, or even that it's to like change their genome. I don't see it, you know?
Well, the thing is, I don't think that it's maybe like an organized sort of planning.
Right.
I think it's more along the lines of these rich people, they want to hang out with other rich people. They want to be friends with other rich people.
Yep.
And they probably have these weird ass conversations when they're like sitting in the jacuzzi drinking. I could see that. Where, like, just a handful of really rich people with a lot of means and power could influence a handful of companies that are really big. So it might seem like there's a larger conspiracy, but it's really just, you know, like, the companies that are controlled by this handful of people.
Yeah, it's very, I hear you. It's very difficult for me to believe in that level of organization that can act on that scale, you know, that can act on that big of a scale. Like, I could believe somebody would try to do this within, say, a city, like a decent sized city, you know, but like all around the world, it becomes tougher for me, you know, to believe that. But you know, if it's true and you're saying that science kind of backs up that this is kind of possible. It's interesting.
Not the soulless part, but like
we'll talk
about genetic expression.
Yeah. I mean, if this is, because that was Alex Jones' argument for the gay frogs, was like, you know, kids are eating potato chips and it's turning them into trans kids, you know, or it's making them gay and whatever. Which that's. That's a whole other conversation that we don't even have to get into around.
No,
you know,
there's a million other factors besides that.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
And also if you know, people don't just become gay, you know,
right.
they either are or they aren't.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I guess to touch on the soul part quickly, I mean, the thing that he's kind of right about, and so I'm guessing he's probably read some Kabbalistic works. But he reads them like, oh, this is the devil, you know, this is the devil, right? Which when I read them, no, this is science. But the point within Kabbalistic works, even though like the concept of the soul is an incredibly, talk about complex, because there's not just one soul. Like souls have multiple parts. It's a very complex thing within Judaism, particularly. Okay. But his point that biology matters to the soul, that the human body and the soul are something that join, and you're not actually a whole being if you don't have both. There's a little bit of truth to that, I think. Like, I mean, again, he's right for the wrong reasons, because Christianity doesn't believe that shit. It doesn't teach that at all, you know, but, within Judaism, Kabbalah. Yeah. Like, I mean, I've been espousing this for a long time. It's like, no, you're not, if you think you're just a spirit, you're not a complete being. You need the physical body. I don't want to get lost on a big tirade on how I can, you know, I can quote unquote prove that within the context of what we're talking about within the, you know, the texts, you know, of say using Torah and, you know, Kabbalistic texts and whatever else, but.
And
you
know, I'd love to have this conversation about the soul sometime.
Yeah,
maybe not in
that.
This episode, but
we can do that in the next one or in the future somewhere. We'll get into that because it really is a fascinating subject because I think it gets into the idea that no, the being is the field, you know, as in like the energy field more so than anyway. We don't have to get lost on it. Those are just some fun teases. Okay, so it's a funny thing, like. Okay, I don't believe that there's some kind of grand conspiracy around this. I also don't think that going vegetarian or vegan is going to turn you into a soulless creature. In fact, if I were to believe the Bible, I would say it's the exact opposite. That you become more like God when you become, vegan and vegetarian. Okay, so he's wrong on that account. You know, again, if we're believing the Bible, okay. In a very literal context, or literal interpretation. But yeah, so you're saying, but scientifically, like, he might not be that far off.
Yeah, I mean, there is some truth to you are what you eat.
Right, right.
That statement, I mean, there's always been a grain of truth in that, too. That
sure.
The things you eat can alter your genetic expression, which can alter, you know, things about your health and wellness
right.
and disease profile.
Right. But it's a pretty good bet it's not Beyond Burger that's going to do that to you.
Well, I would probably go for the Bean Burger before I go for the Beyond Burger.
Yeah, I suppose we'll make that caveat here quick.
Yeah.
We are also not fans of Beyond Burger or Impossible or any of that.
Yeah,
like those,
I mean,
those Frankenburger lab creations are crazy.
We might have talked about this before, but mm-hmm. like if you look at the macronutrient profile of things like Beyond Burger, they are pretty similar to just eating a regular beef patty. Like there's not much advantage. They both have similar protein and saturated fat and sodium profiles.
Right.
And like those last two things are pretty darn bad for your health.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, something like a Bean Burger has a lot of fiber and yeah, it does have like less protein, but it's because it has this amino acid profile that's very different.
Right.
Has no saturated fat. And a host of other, like, phytonutrients that, you know, something like a Beyond Burger would not have.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's no argument here for doing that other than the Bean Burger, like, fucking right. And boy, are those delicious.
Yeah. Or Portobello Burgers. Those are great.
Yeah, those
are
amazing.
Or even, like, the classic soy patty. You know, like, when I was 15 and I first became a vegetarian, those saved my life. I don't know what I would have lived on if I didn't know about those. Because at the time, I didn't know how to be a vegetarian the right way.
Right.
I just knew that people around me were all eating burgers, so I needed to, like, also have a sandwich that I could eat.
Of some kind.
Yeah. Besides peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah. It's like, don't you get it, Rick? We're just trying to like, you know, fit in a little bit. It's a concession to you, you know?
Pretty much. I mean, like, it's only meat eaters, really, that need burgers. Like vegetarians, we can have our protein in so many different ways.
And it's all so good. Well, anyway, speaking of, do you want to switch it up?
Sure.
Okay. Speaking of vegetarians, actually, this is a great question that when I asked it, when I thought about it, I realized I didn't exactly know the question or I didn't know the answer to it.
Okay.
And I was surprised because I pride myself really on my encyclopedic knowledge with just about anything that I've ever bothered to read or research or get into. Okay. But I certainly pride myself on my encyclopedic knowledge when it comes to science fiction. And in Dune, I don't know if the Fremen eat meat.
No.
It would appear not.
As we were watching the series, you were pointing out, like, no, they're eating green stuff there.
Yeah, everything they're eating was vegetables and whatever. And like, I have the appendix pretty decently memorized from the first Dune book. It's my favorite part of the book. And I can think of, like, various types of cacti. I can think of all different types of plants that get mentioned in that. But I can't think of, and I mean, I can think of animals that are in it, but they're never talked about as food like the plants are.
No, there is a mention of hunting scorpions.
Yeah.
But I don't know what happens after, like, are they just hunting them because they're poisonous and they want to get rid of them? Or are they hunting them to eat?
No, my understanding was more that they were, like, they would just kill them because they were dangerous.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
And they would kill people within the siege, mm-hmm. you know, for the Fremen. And yes, folks, I mean, I already said it, but if you're not clear, we're talking about Dune now, baby. And which is the hot topic all around the world right now. In fact, I've heard a bunch of Star Wars fans stop being Star Wars fans and they all became Dune fans. And it's
wow.
like, well, yeah, I mean, in one sense, okay, but boy, I hope you go and read the books. Anyway. All right. So we are going to get into reviewing Dune here. And the potentially, at least in this version of Dune, that being the 2000 miniseries from the Sci-Fi Channel, back when it was the Sci-Fi Channel and not SIFI, the good old days, and I do mean that in every sense of the term, these were golden years, my friends. We are talking about what is officially titled Frank Herbert's Dune, which also has a sequel miniseries that came out a few years later that comprises Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, the two sequels to the book of Dune, with most of the same actors and all that jazz. It's a direct sequel, and we just started recently watching that. Now, we're not going to get into that here, but we are going to talk about the original three-part miniseries, which you and I watched recently, kind of inspired by, you know, of course, the recent Dune film, which we were, I think it's fair to say we were somewhat nonplussed with.
Yeah, I was not thrilled about how that turned out.
Yeah, particularly, I mean, it's a gorgeous film. Like, it's a beautiful film.
Yeah. Like we said in the last movie, it's very impressive visually.
Yeah. No, it really is. And as I said on my recent Q&A, if these two movies, if Denis Villeneuve's movies existed without the Dune books and they were like a completely new creation, I would be blown away. And I would be watching these movies over and over again if I just took them out of context. Right. But when you have the context and you have previous versions made on film, and you have the amazing books, you know, many of which will probably never get turned into any kind of movie or miniseries, it's a pale shadow. It doesn't hold up very well at all. Okay. Now, that said, Frank Herbert's Dune, on the other hand, from 2000, you said earlier, this is, you think, the best version of Dune put to film.
Yeah.
And you stand by that.
I do. I stand by that.
Okay.
And part of the reason that I stand by that is because it's a practically verbatim translation of the book into a visual display. And it's part of the reason that I also love it is because, as opposed to the David Lynch Dune, this Dune has, you know, 2 to 3 times as much time to explore the world.
Yes.
So there's so much more detail put into it.
Yeah, you have almost 300 minutes worth, depending upon what version you watch. There's a lot, you know, to enjoy here. And again, it is in three parts. Now, I want to be clear on this. You and I watched it's an official version. It's the official director's cut. It's not like with David Lynch where there's the longer Alan Smithy version, because that wasn't approved by David Lynch. This was approved by John Harrison, who wrote and directed the miniseries, and it's called the Director's Cut. It was only ever released in the United States on DVD. It was never shown on television because there's a lot of nudity. There's all kinds of stuff in it. Okay. And that wasn't in the television version. So, because at the time, I can tell you, I was there. I mean, you were born too, but you were what, 6? when this came out.
I don't know. What are you talking about here?
Well, I'm
are you trying to ask me how old I am? I'm as old as time.
Yes, you are. So
that's all you need to know.
That's right. So, but I'm just saying that, like, I was, you know, when it came out for me, I was 19 and I, you know, was going to conventions at the time. I had my finger on the pulse of what people thought about this. And a lot of people weren't super happy with it. Now, I don't want to say that it was because they didn't see the director's cut. Okay. But the director's cut does add probably at least a good 30 minutes to it, where it brings in more and more of the book. Like you said, this is such a great, nearly direct translation. Might be a couple things added here or there, but shifted a bit. But it's a very near. I mean, this is the only one that actually to date that shows the first child that, you know, Chani and Paul have, who gets killed. They even went that far. Like, they tried to put everything into it. We get the banquet scene, which we know has been filmed for other versions, including Villeneuve's. But for some reason, nobody ever puts it out. It's one of the best scenes. It's like in the book anyway. And it was awesome to see it in this miniseries, right?
Yeah.
You're totally on point about the fact that, yes, this is probably the most direct translation of the book, frankly, I think, that'll ever get made, you know? So is that really what, but I just want to be fair that for people, you know, you might want to go hunt the director's cut version of this to see everything that is on offer. And it really is worth your time, in my opinion as well. So is that what makes it the best for you? Is just that it's the most direct translation, or are there other elements of this?
Yeah, I'll be honest. Frank Herbert is just a genius.
Yes.
And his writing is beautiful.
Yes.
And the closer that people get to mimicking that, I think the better the content is. So this television series really, really did that. Like, they took it to heart, and I think they respected the work in mm-hmm. a beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
The actors and actresses were all pretty darn good.
Yeah, there's a couple, I think, that are on the weaker side. But for the most part, I think they're on point, which I cannot say for the Villeneuve Dune.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
The sets are incredible. As somebody who's coming from a dramatic theater background,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I love the lighting. I love the choice of very flamboyant outfits.
Yeah.
There's so many different kinds of hats. It's incredible. And gowns and capes and like colorful skin suits. And yeah, it's beautiful. It's very visually grabbing.
Yeah, I think it's a very avant-garde film mm-hmm. as far as the way that it's filmed. Like, in other ways, it's just like the book where it's very, it's kind of straightforward, even though there's a lot of illusion. A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N. Okay. And, you know, this is something you and I haven't watched yet, Ellen, but I think they pulled a lot of the gown designs and everything, especially like the design for the guild navigators for the Spacing Guild. Not the navigators, but the representatives. I think they pulled that out of Jodorowsky's Dune, which he was supposed to make the very first film ever of Dune back in the 60s. There's a great documentary about it because he got all the designs done and everything. And I really felt like they were pulling from that, which I thought was really cool for them to do. And it is fabulous.
And I mean, speaking of copycats, I think the new Dune movie pulled the design for the Harkonnens from a character that is in this Dune movie. And it's Princess Irulan's, one of her maidservants.
Yep. Now that's interesting because that's kind of an added character into the narrative.
Right. But
it was a good addition.
She goes to the Harkonnen household and is told to be the servant of Fade.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's actually something that makes a lot of sense where it's one of the areas where I think they might have slightly added more logic than the book had, where they added in a narrative element that made it all make more sense. But yes, I agree with you because she's bald, right?
No eyebrows.
No eyebrows.
Wears like, all black.
Yep.
Creepy outfit.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that because the design choices for the Harkonnen in Villeneuve's Dune are very strange.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Like, where's the red hair?
Yeah, exactly. Ah, bingo. Well said, which is a big part of it. Yeah. Yeah. So...
Anyway, so getting back to my review, I think that the sets were so gorgeous. They looked so rich. Mm-hmm, like, I would love to live in that castle.
On Arakeen?
Yeah, exactly. Paul, whoever they chose to play Paul, like, he did a really good job. I loved that. And even the tricks with the lighting that they did on the sets, some of the transitions were just incredible, and the whole mood shifted when they did the light transitions. There's so much to love about this, especially the music. And I may be biased on this, but I love television that is filmed from the year 2000 and prior to that. Mm-hmm, older television just hits me right in the warm fuzzies. I don't know why, but it's just got this softness to it that makes it feel almost more real mm-hmm. than modern television does.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, modern television is just too hyper-realistic and they've perfected it to such a degree that it's sterile.
Yes.
Whereas television that's from 20 years ago and older, there's little flaws. But that's what makes it feel like you're actually there.
Yeah, there became, and I think you're onto something. I think in the aughts, there's suddenly, and I can think of shows that probably brought this on, like The Wire and some others, and maybe even before the year 2000, like NYPD Blue, where television did, actually NYPD Blue is maybe the catalyst. Like, that show changed everything for television, and it started this very gritty era for television, which made people think it lent to being more lifelike. I don't think that ended up happening. As to where before that, I feel like television, like you said, I like your use of the word softer. You know, it was something that almost made everything a little more fantastical, a little more welcoming, perhaps. There's something there. And there was really a shift that occurred. I think NYPD Blue is a good one to point at, The Wire and some others, where suddenly there was this hyper-realism, like you said, that became the thing. But that never got me either. That never turned me on. Like 80s and 90s TV is king in my book. Like, I love the way it's filmed. I love everything about it. All the tricks that they pull off. Yeah, phenomenal. This is, you know, speaking quickly also, the spice visions in this. Like, the effects for that.
Oh, those were great.
Yeah. I mean, people will watch this, and I think they'll be like, well, special effects look a little cheap.
Okay, sure.
They do. Yeah, and the CGI, yep, this is very early, inexpensive.
Mm-hmm. The CGI. Technology wasn't there.
No. It's CGI you'd see in a video game at the time, in a PC game or something. But I actually like that.
I feel like they were much smarter with the visual metaphors that they were putting on the screen.
Because this is the thing. I've always said this. It's just like with Babylon 5, which you would agree with me is the greatest show ever made.
Well, this might be a top competitor.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a miniseries. I hear you. But the thing that I always apply, because people watch Babylon 5 and like, oh, geez, like all the space effects look terrible, you know, whatever. And I'm like, yeah, but that doesn't really matter, because did you get to tell the story on the grandest scale? Yes. Okay. Then I don't care what the effects look like. If the effects look cheap, but it tells the grand scale of the story, then it's a win, in my opinion. Like the worm design in this miniseries.
It's actually great.
Yes, it is. It's phenomenal.
The best. The best looking worm, I think, of the different renditions that we've seen.
Yeah, because it looks as good as the Lynch's Dune worms look. I think the ones in Villeneuve's look ridiculous.
You barely even see them. They don't really come out of the sand that
much. No, right. The ones in Lynch's Dune look like worms, look like earthworms. And we get that. But these look alien.
They have like a hinged mouth.
Yes.
It's not just the big gaping hole. Like, yes, it does get to that eventually, but it's more like a snake's mouth where mm-hmm. like it starts out with a jaw and then the jaw pops open to reveal the full circle of teeth.
Yeah. I really dig it. Like I love the look.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, even though the effects may look rough, I don't care, because they went with it anyway, and it tells the story as big as the story needs to be, and it needs to be big.
It does. I mean, Paul's like the man who can be in many places at once.
Right.
How do you tell that story?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the other thing, too. Like, again, the spice visions in this are dynamite. Like they're so well, like they're so weird and they just went with it. They're just like, no, we're just going to go weird. You know, not any of like the weird negative effects that were done in the David Lynch's Dune. Again, I'm not knocking
but
those.
But this is a weird story that is being told.
Yes.
Like, this is a story about people that are like evolving to a new dimension of human existence.
Right.
It has to be weird by nature. And the one thing that I hate about the new Dune is that they try to make Paul seem like a normal guy. He's just a normal guy. He doesn't want to be this Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah.
But, like, that's not Paul. Paul in the story is, you know, he's embracing this journey. He's embracing his visions.
Right. Yeah, no, that was my number one complaint with the Dune that came out in 2021, Villeneuve's first part, was they took out the weird. Like, they didn't explain the Mentats at all. They didn't do any of that. You know, like all the great weirdness of Dune, I feel like basically got ripped out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this completely embraces it. Not only that, but like you said with Paul, holy shit, you actually get time to evolve, but partly because it's in three parts, you know, it's 300 minutes or so, but it actually spans the years.
Right.
You know, like obviously, unlike in the new movie, Alia actually gets born, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which makes sense when you get into the next miniseries, of course, as well. But, I love that it gets to breathe and spend the time. This is I think a lot of people would probably watch this miniseries today, and I think they'd say, oh, that, boy, this is boring. This is very plotting and slow. But that's what I love about it. Like, man, don't give me, I don't need the Fast and the Furious on worms, man. Like, I don't want that. And I don't need the high school love story either. I want, you know, something that is fucking alien and takes the time and explores this incredible world that Frank Herbert built. That's why his novel, partly why his novel was so popular in the first place.
Right.
You know, science fiction's answer to Lord of the Rings. And no one would ever say, oh, make Lord of the Rings shorter. Fuck you. No one would say that. In fact, anything, when Peter Jackson released the 6-hour versions of each of those movies, everybody's like gobbling them up. Like, yeah, I'll take that. Like, okay, well, here you go. Here's 6 hours of Dune, as it should be. Or not 6 hours, but, you know, 4 something. Anyway, yeah. What else did you feel about this? Like I said, the music, yeah, Graham Revell did a phenomenal job with the score. That was, I really like that. You mentioned the actors were on. What did you think of the Baron Harkonnen in this?
Oh, I thought he was, for as silly a man as he is,
he was kind of silly.
He was also somewhat imposing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, not that he's like necessarily bloodthirsty,
right?
But you could sense that, yeah, he is a bit unhinged.
Yeah, yeah, like he has no problem killing anybody. And you know, I love some of the dialogue, the way they talk about like their servants. You know, like get that out of here. And
yeah,
like
yeah.
They don't even talk about them like they're people, you know. And I love the effect of just turning the camera angle to make everything look unhinged. Like, yeah, okay, that was a nice touch too. You got to warm up to him, but I think for a lot of people that would watch it, Baron Harkonnen, you like him a lot more going back retroactively after seeing the sequel miniseries, that being Children of Dune. But he's great from the beginning anyway, like you said.
Yes, yeah, yeah. He is. And he always has. He says things in rhymes. It's, I don't know, kind of a silly way to make him seem more like a villain, I guess.
Yeah, it's a little goofy. It's a little twirl the mustache. But it's also, you know, it fits with some of the theatrical avant-gardeness of it.
Right,
I think.
Right. He's kind of like the jester.
Yes.
But a dangerous one.
Right, right. Exactly. How about the Emperor? The Emperor, I feel like, gets so much exposure in this. Like, we get so much of him.
Mm-hmm.
He's really a fully fleshed out character, or a very fleshed out character anyway. We also get Count Fenring in this, which has not been in any. I mean, Lady Fenring was in the new movie, but it wasn't Count Fenring, who is a very important character because he's one of those almost Kwisatz Haderachs,
mm-hmm.
right? They directly say that in the original Dune book. What did you think about them actually being in the film?
Oh, I thought it was great. I mean, it was just more like fulfilling the story as it should be told.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Emperor really felt like he was the Emperor of the known universe, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you get to see him commanding, and he's really commanding. Like, he's believable.
Right. Yeah, and you also get the sense that, like, he really cares about his daughter. And in my opinion, I mean, you can see in ways that he doesn't, but in his eyes, like, the villain never thinks he's the villain. Right.
Right. He's like trying to protect her, but she doesn't want to be protected. She's like a rebellious teenager that just wants to get out of the house once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like he's because, I mean, every one of these does a good job of showing the Baron Harkonnen as being like a major villain, but they don't always do a great job of showing Shaddam the Fourth as a villain. And he very much is.
Right. Which is why Paul essentially threw him out.
Yeah. Right. Right. Because, I mean, he is, you know, if we were to put it in video game terms, he's the final boss. And without any development of him, who cares? You know, but you actually get development of him in this. You get an understanding of how serious he takes all this. He's bringing the entire palace to Arrakis, you know, in it. And they explore all that and all the houses are with him and everything. I mean, you really, like, you get to understand why the Fremen just can't fucking stand these people. You know, and why Paul feels like, no, they've got to go down, you know, and I don't think you get that in any other version of Dune. So. And of course, to this miniseries credit, it ends the way the book ends with a very simple line, you know, that history will remember us as wives. Did you feel and we'll wrap this up. Okay.
Yeah, because we could talk about Dune for a long
Forever.
Time.
Yeah, I want to wrap this up, but I want to get this point in. Okay. Did you feel, Ellen, that line at the end, did you feel that this movie was somehow not feminist enough or anti-feminist? Because a big deal about the Villeneuve Dune is that, no, this is the real first feminist Dune. Dune itself was never feminist. That's literally what these people are saying.
I don't know. I feel like that's kind of inflating what people are saying. I don't know. Maybe conflating.
Go ahead.
Like, I have always said that, like, Dune is inherently feminist.
Yes.
Because, like, the Bene Gesserit are a, I don't know if you want to call them a school, a belief structure, a teaching, all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
They're an organization of women and women only that basically manipulate, control, direct the fate of humanity.
Sure.
And they are well respected and feared. Mm-hmm. And like people take orders from them. So they're kind of a ruling class.
Yeah.
In Dune, in the Dune series, right up there with like the guildsmen.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically
the spacing guild,
right?
Or Chome, like they're another competing power in the universe.
Yeah, that's something that's not mentioned in this at all. Is Chome? Not really. And that. Oh well, but anyway, continue. Sorry.
So there's that.
Yeah.
The other thing is that Paul and Chani's relationship in this series is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And part of that is that it's earned. Like, yes. They really take their time. They don't fall in love immediately. Like, Paul meets Chani, and she's, like, kind of belligerent towards him.
Yes.
And she's like, you dumb white guy, why don't you just follow me and do exactly what I do and
right.
don't get yourself killed.
Right.
And it takes, like, months for him, like, learning from her and learning from the community living in the desert before... they even, like, have their first kiss.
Yeah, yeah. One of the points I want to bring up quick about the feminism, she's basically, when they do finally fall in love, she's handling his light work. Like, I mean...
yeah, and, she's the one, she's like, killing people who come to challenge him because
right.
they weren't worthy enough.
Right. Now, that's not, like, an anti-feminist statement when I say she's handling his light work. I'm saying she kills all the people who think they're good enough to kill Muad'Dib. Because she's that much of a badass, like she's that tough, you know, she's killing men, right? Like, it's the idea that somehow, you know, women weren't powerful in this movie is fucking horseshit. Anyway,
yeah, and
continue.
She's the one that's teaching Paul, like, the survival skills of the desert.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and she's a super powerful character throughout the movie.
Yes.
There's nothing about her that seems jealous or weak.
Right.
Which I think, you know, she's terribly misrepresented in the Villeneuve Dune.
Yeah, a statement we kept, or at least I kept saying during when we were watching this is like, boy, somebody should have told that to Zendaya.
Yeah, you know? There's a line in this movie where Paul asks Chani, do you think it's possible to love someone enough that you would have to lose them? Or
something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's what he's saying. Like, that's his point, is like, mm-hmm. can you love somebody enough to let them go, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I think it's possible. I think sometimes there are forces at play that are larger than both of us,
yeah.
essentially.
Yeah.
And that's just not something that you would get in a modern Dune movie.
Yeah, no.
Like, no, the acknowledgement that there's forces at play that are bigger than
mm-hmm.
a single person or two people. And that, like, you know, orgies happen or the...
Which they do in this movie.
Yeah.
In the miniseries, by
oh,
the way.
Everybody's on drugs. Everybody's
yep.
having sex.
Yep.
Like, they're all getting naked, taking off their still suits, getting changed into their, like, day or their nightwear clothing.
Yeah.
And like, nobody is shy about it.
Nope.
There's just asses everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, they couldn't wait to start drinking that water life. They were yeah. on board. Yes.
yeah. And also, Chani is, like, basically saying to Paul, I understand if you need to get married to another woman and
mm-hmm.
that's like royalty in a different house. That's okay, because I want you to, like, have that power that you're seeking.
Right.
And that's something that Jessica was talking to Chani about, too, in this movie, that she didn't marry Paul's father, Leto,
mm-hmm.
because she thought that it would give him a political advantage if he was always single.
Yeah, it was perceived as some kind of greater good.
Right.
That also benefited herself and her love, so it was enlightened self-interest.
Exactly.
Even if the concept of greater good is philosophical nonsense, within the context of the story, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and she says that she would have encouraged that.
Right.
In Leto. She would have encouraged him to get married to someone else.
Yeah.
If it would have given them that advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, here's another strong character, that being Jessica, in the sense that she defies, you know, you were just talking about how the Bene Gesserit and the Spacing Guild, they're basically the two greatest powers in the universe until Paul shows up. Okay. She defies one of the most powerful forces in the universe, that being the Bene Gesserit, by having a son. Because she loved her duke so much. You know, she loved her husband, her duke. I mean, it's concubinage. Anyway, yep. She loved him so much. It's like, no, I'll have a son. I will stand against this order that runs so much of the universe, and I will give you a son instead of a daughter. That's amazing, you know?
It is. Yeah, that's so beautiful.
Yes,
that
exactly.
People could love each other that much.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think this is such a mature film. I think it's very pro-feminist. I think you're making a great case for that. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up on that?
No, continue, please.
Yeah. It's far more mature than the modern film. The modern film is teeny bopper bullshit. Or the modern, you know, like Villeneuve stuff. Really, like, that's the only way I could describe it. This is teeny bopper horseshit. This is Mean Girls in space. And and it's annoying, you know. I was willing to give it a shot. But that's ultimately what it comes down to in comparison, because I'm not even saying that Mean Girls is necessarily like this terrible film, but I'm just saying that in comparison to its source material, it's an insult.
Yeah. And like the way that Chani awakens Paul from his trance or mm-hmm. his sleep after mm-hmm. he drinks the water of life, she knows what it tastes like.
Yes.
Because she had this prior experience where she was like, kind of inducted into the Bene Gesserit sisterhood.
Yeah, she was a Sayyidina. Yeah, right.
Right, just for this ceremony where Jessica drinks the water of life and then she throws it up and everybody gets to party with it. So, like, she knows what it tastes like. She has this experience. She tastes it on Paul's lips when she finds out that he's, like, passed out for weeks.
Yeah, when she kisses him.
Yeah, she's sad and she kisses him. And she's like, oh, he had the water of life, so maybe we should, like, just give him a little bit more because he's in this trance. And she does it willingly because
yes.
she loves him and she wants him to be in her life.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Villeneuve version, that scene is so fucking different.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's crazy. I mean, for one thing, like, okay, Chani knows what to do in this movie. No, we need to give him more water of life. People argue with her saying, oh, that'll kill him. She's like, no, he'll die if he doesn't get it.
Right.
And so she literally saves Paul's life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, he didn't save hers. It's the other way around. As to where in the Villeneuve movie, it's just Chani cries and she like puts.
But she was forced to do it.
Right. She was forced to because she didn't want to do
Jessica.
It or whatever. Yeah. Right. Because, oh yeah, she used the voice.
Yeah. Yeah. So Chani puts
her
tear.
That's not creepy. Oh.
In the water of life and then gives it to Paul forcibly. And then when Paul wakes up, the first thing she does is she fucking punches him in the face and runs away.
Yeah, right, right. But she doesn't give him the water of life. Doesn't she just put her tears in his mouth?
I thought she mixed it with the water and then puts a drip of that on his lips.
Maybe, I don't know. I'll have to watch it again. But I just thought that scene was, you're totally right. That scene was ridiculous.
Yeah, like, Chani had to be forced to do that, and
yeah.
now she hates Paul because he chose to take the water of life. Like, this is completely changing the meaning of their relationship.
Right.
And the direction of the movie.
Right. Right.
And, like, all of these relationships are turning out to be tragic. Like, Jessica to Chani and Chani to Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, as to where in the miniseries, again, I mean, sticks very close to the book, but I think it comes off as, again, incredibly mature.
Yes.
And beautiful. They're like, the relationships are actually beautiful. Very, very sweet, at points even innocent, which, you know, one of the meta themes I think of Dune is, like, you know, the end of innocence, right? Is what, you know, Paul goes through. But there's points to this that are so beautifully innocent. I love it. Yeah. Yeah. So upon me rewatching it, I think I agree with you. Like, this is the best version of Dune we're probably ever going to get.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And I want to watch it over and over again. Like,
I'm ready for that.
Yeah. I was so blown away because I think it's a case of you don't know how great something is until you see how bad it can be. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, yeah. It's like the old saying of, you know, if only we knew when the golden years were, it's fine at the end, but just let us know when they're here and we'll enjoy them while they're here. And this is one of those cases where, like, you know, this, I didn't realize how great this was until I saw how bad Dune could be. And Villeneuve has shown how bad it can be. And so now I know how great it can be. You know, like, you can't appreciate the sweet without the sour, that classic line.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the other thing is, like, you probably haven't seen this in years,
it's
right?
It's been a long time. Yep.
Yeah, and the only reason you're watching it with me now is because, well, actually, there's two reasons. I mean, one, we just watch everything together.
Yes. It's
and
amazing.
You love introducing me into things that I've never seen before.
Yeah, and you just swallow it whole. I mean, it's so great.
I do every love drop, to swallow.
Every drop, you're just like, oh, give me more. It's so wonderful.
Yes.
Sorry, please continue.
But the other thing is, there's so much Dune hype.
Yeah.
The last couple years.
Yeah.
And frankly, it's a bit annoying because, like, most people that are into Dune now or that are watching Dune, they, like, never read the books before. They're not even into sci-fi, really, unless
right.
you count Star Wars as sci-fi, which...
Not really.
Yeah. But anyway, you get my point.
Yes, it's like, totally.
Before the year, what was it, 2019, 2020,
mm-hmm.
the only people that knew about Dune were hardcore sci-fi fanatics.
Yeah.
And now it's, like, fucking everyone.
Yeah, and it's annoying because, as you've brilliantly stated to me, certainly and elsewhere many times, you know, like, without God Emperor of Dune, you don't understand Dune.
Yeah,
you can't.
You just can't understand the plot that is being laid out
right.
in the first Dune book.
Right. So the thing is, even, you know, when I was younger, and there were a lot of people that had read Dune, most of them never went further than the first book, you know, and you keep getting, like, as you go down the list, less and less people have read them, you know, to the point that I think the people that have gotten to God Emperor are a pretty elite group. Because most people just, they don't go there, but when they do, they're hooked for life.
Yeah.
You know? And that's sad. And I agree with you because it feels like this all feels like, to use a term, this all feels like AstroTurf. It's like, oh yeah. Okay. You're into Dune, but you're not into Dune. Like you're, and it's okay if you enjoy these, like, the Villeneuve movies. I don't think there's necessarily a problem with that, but, like, understand where this shit came from and why people might not like it, you know? And part of that is, the big part of that is it's a slap to the face. If anything got slapped to the face when Chani slapped Paul, that was a slap to the face of the entire book series.
Pretty
in my
much.
Opinion. Yeah. And so that's why I think a lot of people are like, no, these movies are, you know, no, I don't get it. Like, this again, pale shadow. Anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, I love this series, and yep. I'd love to watch it over and over again. I'm glad that we still have Messiah and Children of Dune to finish watching.
Well, we watched the first part of that. You feeling good?
Yeah, yeah. I'm so excited to see the rest of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, the first part, they basically did Dune Messiah. I thought it was awesome. I mean, so well done. I'm glad you're enjoying it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
I only wish that they had gone further.
I know. If only they made God Emperor.
If only.
Could change the world.
Such a long series, though.
It would be. But literally could change the world if they did.
And maybe that's why they won't ever make it.
If there were a genuine conspiracy out there, that's one of them.
Like, yeah, because nobody wants to learn the lesson of the worm.
Yeah. Yeah. No. No one wants to learn the lesson of the old worm, and no one wants to learn the golden path.
The golden path!
All right. On that note, I think we should wrap this thing up. We did end up... Oh, wow. We're almost getting to 2 hours. Okay.
What was that about? We're only going to...
Yeah, it's
going to
be a short
hour?
Episode. Yeah.
We only had one story.
One story. Yeah.
And then, like, a side subject. A little one.
It's what you get. You get two minds like this together, it's what happens.
Damn.
So, all right. We'll wrap this one up. Ellen, of course, always just beyond a pleasure to have you on.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yes. And we are going to go engage in some other pleasures. So we will see all of you on the other side.
Woo!
Thank you for listening to Sovereign Tech X. This part of the journey is over, but the story of Sovereign Tech
is just beginning.
Was this evening everything you hoped it would be?
Everything, and so much more.
Woo!
Woo!